What I'd like to do is open with two readings, really. One is to follow up on the story that I shared last week of actually finding this divinity bulletin on the dentist's, on the table in my dentist. It's the Harvard Divinity Bulletin. It's not People Magazine or, you know, or Men's Fitness or Outdoor Life or anything like that, or Vogue. I've never seen it, as I said then, outside my mailbox. And then from that, there were a series of events that happened that day, actually, and synchronicity that ended up with me finding out about and then attending the memorial service for Professor Richard R. Niebuhr at Memorial Church in Harvard Yard this Friday. He was my favorite professor, I would say that, but also the one who made me struggle with how to articulate and my orientation to religion after my religious sort of awakening to that sense of something more, but how to put it into words and how to in experience and how to live it. He was the one who impressed on me that belief is not a word for assent to propositions. It's the word that talks about our deepest values from which our habits emerge. So that if you look backwards, that your habits actually tell you what you value and then what your real beliefs are. Experiential religion, he called it. That was on Friday. I've forgotten that 2016 was the Divinity School's 200th anniversary, actually its bicentennial year. I had time to spare between an appointment and the service, and that was just on Friday. So I strolled through Andover Hall, something I never really did, but that's where I spent a lot of time. And I was, it's the central old building of the school. And I looked through the exhibit on the walls that they had for the bicentennial, and it was called Faces of Diversity, Envisioning, and Ron used the word, inclusion. Actually used exclusion, but envisioning inclusion for 200 years. There were topics like non-sectarian to multi-religious, and this was all with pictures of events, Unitarian Universalists and Harvard Divinity School, histories and anthropologies, theology and ethics. These were different panels. The ministry, across the street, across the world, that was the Center for the Study of World Religions. Women, gender, and religion. African and African-American studies. Hebrew Bible and Jewish studies. Islamic studies. Asian religions. New Testament and early Christian studies. Divinity Hall. Worship and gathering. Religion and social justice. The study of religion for 200 years from Harvard Divinity School and from its Unitarian beginnings. That's how it was founded. And they even characterized Unitarianism back then as a moral philosophy, and that was part of that non-sectarian time of a long time to then becoming multi-religious. And this is the reading from the bulletin that I want to share with you by one of the professors, Stephanie Paulsell, who addressed the 2017 graduates. So these are the Divinity School graduates. And she's questioning, what does it mean in this time of such turmoil and things happening to actually do this work? And she talks about Tim DeChristopher, soon to be an MDiv graduate. He's also a Unitarian Universalist minister now at this point, who was an active climate activist and had also been in jail for 2 years for an act of civil disobedience, and why he was doing this. And he said, because the question for me is starting to shift from how do we reverse climate change to how do we remain human? How do we remain human as these changes overtake us? Then she says, that our work that is most necessary to do is to bear witness to the multiple and radical possibilities that humanity holds. And this is the reading. She goes into text by Ralph Waldo Emerson, Unitarian minister, from his Divinity School address. When Ralph Waldo Emerson addressed Harvard Divinity graduates in 1838, he urged them to, quote, cast behind you all conformity and acquaint men, that was all they were in front of them at the time, acquaint men at first hand with deity. What he seems to have meant by this memorable phrase is that he wanted those graduates to be so human in their interactions with other people that they opened a space for others to stretch out into their full humanity. So this is addressing graduates at Harvard Divinity School after 200 years of all these different aspects of what is religion and how do we approach it and what we should believe. And this is what it's being boiled down to in this moment, and also what it comes back to us as. Open a space for others to stretch out into their full humanity, to coax out what he called their timid aspirations and trampled instincts. To, quote, let their doubts know that you have doubted, and their wonder feel that you have wondered. Everyone, Emerson believed, longed for, quote, a few real hours of life, close quotes. Everyone, he said, loves to be heard and loves to be, quote, caught up into the vision of principles. She said it is the responsibility of those who have the word divinity trailing along behind them. I would say it is the responsibility of each of us to make room in the world for encounters that are real, that touch down on the things that matter most, and that draw out the most radical possibilities of our humanity. She says we are living in a time of trampled instincts about what it means to be human. We see those trampled instincts in the executive orders that sort people by religion and nationality. We see them in the decision by United Airlines to use state power to drag Dr. David Dow out of his seat and down the aisle of their plane so that they could seat their own employees. We hear those trampled instincts in Officer Darren Wilson's testimony about why he shot Michael Brown, in which he described the young man as a, quote, demon, who seemed to be, quote, bulking up to run through, close quotes, the bullets, like a character in a comic book. Human beings can't run through bullets unharmed. If we think they can, there is something dangerously wrong in our understanding of human being. Make room in the world for encounters that are real, that touch down on the things that matter most, that draw out the most radical possibilities of our humanity. So that afternoon, after walking through the Divinity School, I went to the memorial service for Professor Niebuhr in Memorial Church in Harvard Yard. And Courtney Lamberth, who was one of Professor Niebuhr's doctoral students and is now director of undergraduate studies, opened her remarks from an essay that Professor Niebuhr did, and it's one that I studied quite a bit. It begins, it's from a book called Streams of Grace, and it was a sermon delivered in Japan about the haiku poet Basho and his pilgrimage across Japan. And so these are just a few quick things from my notes. And yes, I took notes in Professor Niebuhr's memorial service. I started not to, and then I realized, well, that's what I did all the time anyway. So I kind of quietly pulled it out and did it. But it's from Streams of Grace. And the text for that sermon, by the way, is Matthew, and I've forgotten the verse, but it's the eye is the lamp of the body. So it's about how do we see. And it was on pilgrimage. And he said, in a pilgrimage, vision becomes single or capacious and generous. He says, make it a habit to notice, to be quiet and look again at the world. Just stop with that phrase, be quiet. Oh my gosh, how hard is that? Be quiet and look again at the world. He said, then perception is transformed by a creative and generative force that is not our own. Make the universe your companion, said Basho. Make the universe your companion. The great body of life to which we belong shall be renewed in us and we in it. I had no idea that these remarks or this experience would set the context for this week's remarks. I sort of knew what I wanted to cover, but I'm starting, for some of you don't know, of talking a little bit about time from my vacation, where I took time off and went away to Panama, and it turned out I also went to very bad cell phone reception and no Wi-Fi. So I had thought of my vacation as time away, but not as pilgrimage. And to some degree, it's really true. It was a time where I came to seeing differently. It also a time where I definitely came to feeling more human. I wrote in the newsletter about that vacation, about taking a break, about the sign that said in the bottom of the hostel that said, no Wi-Fi, go surf. So I did. But only sporadically, then hearing outside news, and there were a few headlines a few times a week. And here's some of what I missed. I missed that, now I'm blanking on his name. The press secretary, the first one, yeah, I knew you'd do it right away, but I'm doing it. Sean Spicer had left or was fired, and then I missed that Mooch was hired, and I missed that he was fired, and that somebody else was hired. And that's by way of saying, I didn't find out until I heard what I just related to you and got to laugh about it, but I didn't live my days in that drama. And also, trying to check the news and the people I wanted to hear to see what happened next, I checked out of that reality TV show, and then I checked in later. And I concluded my piece in the Beacon by saying it takes 21 days to create new habits. I haven't been back long enough to know if or how long the effects will last. But I like being a little more unplugged and able to check in on news headlines only once or twice a day and to do it on my terms. I like being better able to take a break. I didn't just get away. I got out of touch. And that is the point. I got out of touch with the world and in touch with myself. For the first time in a long time, I thought for myself. And I like feeling awake. I like feeling more alive. I like surfing the real waves of my life and loves and intentions on my terms. And I think we all do. With so much going on and happening around us, I know I said this column is very much out of touch in important and real ways. I can tell you that this morning I'm driving and I turn on the radio and I hear that there are protests in St. Louis over the verdict, that not guilty verdict of the police officer who shot, and I'm embarrassed to say I've forgotten the man's name, I killed him. But it's my way of naming and bringing back a gift from the journey. You can discount it as you want, but it's getting back in touch, all the while hoping to somehow keep in touch with the love and power and joy that lives in each and every one of us. So now let's get to the title and the picture on the front of the order of service. There's another narrative that was ongoing while I was there without concern for me. Sea turtles. were nesting. There are 5-6 species of sea turtles. The females literally emerge out of a wave and move their way up the beach, where they then shape a hole with their hind flippers, this rounded, perfect little hole, and lay upwards of 100 eggs at a time. We walked the beach at night and usually saw one or two, and these were mostly olive ridley sea turtles coming out to nest. Sea turtles have been nesting like this for over 100 million years. Against great odds, they have survived. It takes a turtle over 10 years to reach maturity. You can think of it almost being on the same time scale as human beings. And then it takes many years and thousands of miles of ocean. Perhaps only 1 in 1,000 eggs laid makes it to adulthood. And that's before the arrival of humans, and perhaps even before the human population grew as much as it has, and its demands for meat and eggs and beachland grew as much as they have in just the last, I would say, 70 years. They have a word for the beach where a lot of them come up at once. It's called an arribada. And arribada means arrival. There are only 2 species of turtle, the olive ridley and the Kemp's ridley, that nest in these mass arrivals or arribadas, where hundreds or thousands of turtles come out on the same beach on the same night to lay their eggs. They call it synchronized nesting in mass numbers. We were seeing the olive ridley on the Pacific coast, and it turns out that their numbers have dropped from 10 million before this mass exploitation to 2 million in 2004, and then to 850,000 by 2008. A decrease of almost 60% in one generation. But if you look at it recently, conservation efforts, that means the effort to see this differently and to do differently. You don't think conservationists or ecologists, or it's just people trying to live into their full humanity. These efforts have and are making a difference. Remember that quote from Professor Niebuhr: vision becomes single. When vision becomes single, you focus. It can become capacious and generous. The Swiss owner of the hostel where my friend Steve and I stayed, it was called Surf Camp Guanaco, usually had 2 to 4 international volunteers running the hostel. And Mark from England was about 25 years old, and he'd been there for over 2 months, and he was a very dramatic, effusive, kind, wonderful guy. And he was in charge of the vivero, or the turtle nursery. And what he did was he moved recently laid eggs. You have to get them right away because their sex is determined by the temperature in the nest, and the egg also forms in a way that if you move it, the embryo dies after the first several hours. So he moved recently laid eggs from the beach into the fenced enclosure to protect them from poachers and dogs. And one day he came running into the open area of the hostel with a newly hatched turtle in his hand, and he said, "We have babies." We're all sitting around. "We have babies," he exclaimed. And so by the time they'd finished bubbling up through the sand, one on top of the other, he had over 100 baby loggerheads in a 5-gallon bucket. So that's all these baby turtles. And so later that afternoon or that evening, we all gathered around and released them like halfway down the beach. Mark drew a line and then a box, and he said, "That's the starting line, and you can't step in there because you might step on turtles." And he had this whole routine done. But we had to release them only halfway down the beach, and you wanted to just put them in the waves, you know, these tiny little things, and so they would imprint on this beach, to which maybe one would survive and return in over 10 years. They knew where to head. They knew which direction to go, unlike us. And I realized in that moment that their little 3-inch tracks, or 2.5, were identical to the 3.5-foot wide tracks they would make the next time they came ashore. And that's only the females. Little tiny turtles crawling on brand new flippers directly into the big surf of the Pacific Ocean. The last one in this bunch was a little smaller than the rest, and I followed her as she made it to the edge of the water, and then she was tumbled over and over by just the gentle wash of the wave, so all you could see in the foam was one flipper and then another flipper of this little turtle, and again, you wanted to pick her up and put her in the water. So one flipper occasionally visible before she swam out to sea with only 10 years and thousands of miles to go before she came back. I was surprised and moved by how attached I got to this turtle in that space. I didn't name her, as Mark suggested when he said, you can name her, you can name them, or you can just give them numbers. But he suggested we do it. But I might have named her, what? Hope. Exactly. Or Lucky. The hostel wasn't usually full, but this week it was, with a Swiss family and their two boys and a German man and his 2, 7, and 8-year-old girls who were in from their home in Panama City. And an evening after dinner, Mark told us about a turtle that had come up on the beach nearby, and so we all went out and watched her from a distance as she got held up in the logs of the inlet. And if you can imagine a turtle falling over and through and around logs that you couldn't walk over, then she gave up and went back to the sea. But as we were doing that, the poacher's headlamp from down the beach checked us out from time to time to see if it was safe to come get those eggs once they were laid. We learned in the morning that he was also drunk and carrying a machete. But as we walked back to the hostel, Kimya, and that's K-I-M-I-A, I know because she said when I asked her, she said, I'll spell it for you. And then she said, I'll write it down. She was 7. And she was upset and mad about how awful it was to have your babies taken away. It's that kind of focus and connection. Imagine if you were a mother, she fumed as she kicked her way in the sand in front of me, and you had your babies taken away. Local conservationists, or regular people, lived in the village of Guanaco, Abajo, which was a couple miles away. It's just hundreds of people. And all the time we were there, they were gearing up for the first Arribada festival. The Arribada was going to happen sometime in late August, September, and the festival was going to be held a week after we left. They also patrolled the beach nightly. They knew the poachers. They're people in the village. One of the leaders dated one of the poachers and told the story of, it's a habit he can't break. Because he went out with me, and I had to tell him, no, put those eggs back, because he had hid 6 in his pockets. But you're shaking your head, and I was too, but this is community. They're figuring out how to live together in this. And the goal of these people was to work together and live together and educate everyone to the value and beauty of the turtles and their value to the village, the value of ecotourism, to the earth, yes, but also to the economy. The school children were making turtles and boats to sell at the festival, and one of the mothers worked at the hostel, and I walked with her after work to the school and bought this wooden plaque, wooden picture. I wanted something Panamanian, and it says, Recuerdo de Guanaco, so a record of or remembering. And these are first to sixth grade. I didn't realize that there were only 6 students in the school. I was expecting a lot of choice, and there were only 12 items because they'd only made 2 things so far, so I bought one. And then I wrote in my journal after the night with the poacher that I experienced turtles with a disheartening sense in the face of us, all of us, that all of it I was discounting by this sense of, this is awful. How does this make it? They're facing 2 great odds. Yet I noted that I was wearing this hope shirt that I bought from Emma's Revolution at GA when I was writing that in my journal. And all of that is connected. Is that turtle nesting an example of fundamental hope, not just survival instinct? How are they different, I ask myself in my notes. Maybe they're a model of something basic, fundamental, to this opportunity space that we are living in, that we call life. I know it's a leap, but if you think about turtles as more than hardwired, that's what we do. We think they're just hardwired. It opens up to thinking about something about them that seems hopeful. Maybe it's just, it's hopeful to me in some way. Turtles don't give up. And you go, because they can't. But you just think about it as life and as fundamental and foundational. 150 million years. They don't give up because the odds are stacked against them. They're always showing up and living their lives in the face of it all. They're always giving it what they've got. They don't despair. Maybe because you can say they don't hope as we know it. But there's something going on. They don't not do it because they might fail. They don't hold back because they're not the best at it. If joy is the felt experience of right living and belonging, turtles enjoy turtle life. And I can see furrowed brows going, how does this apply to me? But just think about it. We are those beings too that have this being in us. The festival is that way as well, a celebration, an enjoyment in the face of it all. It's not sitting around talking about how awful it is and spending our time doing that. It was making crafts, it was making food, it was figuring out how to be together and to dance and to celebrate and to hold up while all this was going on. And the goal of that was to change what was going on in the future. I got a text last night when I sent Joan Morris a text that said, I'm back. I'd let her know I was leaving it. And I said, I'm back and I'm I've arrived safe and mostly sound. And she texted back, don't stress. Turtles wouldn't stress. The morning after we'd released the turtles, the surf was good. And as Kimya's dad, Bruno, got ready to go out, she came up to him and in a genuine, concerned voice said, Dad, be careful. There's a baby turtle out there. And she turned to do something else, but turned right back to her dad and added in a more upbeat tone, if you see it, say hello. Dad smiled and nodded and hurried off to the ocean. I smiled and made a mental note. On my way home from Panama, I spent a couple of days in my hometown, partly so I could spend time with Steve's mother, Helen. Helen's 98. Helen and her husband, Ken, were my models for engaged life, of how to do this juggling of hope and living and effort. Their passion was conservation and environmental activism. All her life, she was a doer to make a difference. One of the questions I asked her was, Helen, did you teach Audubon in our elementary school once a month? And she said, no, it was once a week. She taught Audubon class once a week as volunteer, and my mother taught music, both of them on the same kind of schedule. And we would all go to the auditorium for those classes. All her life, she was a doer to make a difference, and to, like the festival and the villagers, to educate, to grow a difference, and to engage in politics, to help change things for the better. She was and is living hopefully. She has lived a life worth living. Her husband, Ken, always greeted me with a smile and a hello, friend. Helen says, it's so good to see you. They loved and wondered and doubted and enjoyed life. Helen's seen a lot. She's lived in the way villagers are working to help the turtles and educate the community are living. Steve had given her the other turtle picture and told our turtle stories over dinner. We shared our excitement and a few surfing adventures. And before I left, I told her my no Wi-Fi freedom from daily political drama story and how it was such a different use of my time and a different feeling for me. I'd hugged her twice and asked if I could kiss her and said goodbye. And I'd walked over to the kitchen and I'd actually opened the jalousie door to leave. If you've ever opened a jalousie door, you know that distinct sound it makes of the windows rattling. And just Helen's bent over now and getting frail, but just as that sound of the windows rattling that's so much a part of entering and leaving their house, she said in a quiet, clear voice, keep living life. I will, I said. And as I write this, I realize that I didn't just say it, I promised. Hope undaunted, somehow. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, good instincts untrampled. Making room in our lives and the world for encounters that are real, that touch down on things that matter most and that draw out the most radical possibilities of not just being human, but our full humanity. Acquainted firsthand with deity and right relationship. Don't get so caught up in the drama that we miss the experience of living and caring and loving. Don't discount it for what it isn't, because it is the strength that allows you to fight the fight. The living, caring, and loving we've been given, and that gives us hope and heart to carry on.